I'm Liz Guinness, and welcome to Talking Australia. Today I'm chatting with Brigitte Muir, one of my all-time adventure heroes. Brigitte was the first Australian woman to summit Everest and the first woman ever to climb the seven summits. Her take on the world is nothing short of extraordinary, and it's my complete pleasure to chat with her today. So sit back and enjoy the conversation. Welcome to Talking Australia, Brigitte, and it's an absolute honour to be speaking with you today.
Thank you, Liz.
Obviously, our conversation today will be kind of wide-ranging. For people who don't know who you are, and they must have been living under a rock somewhere very far away.
Oh, they must be young.
No, come on now. We're young. We're all young. It would be great if you could just give a little recap of those years. So for me, I guess it would start, obviously it started when you were much younger and interested in climbing, but in terms of achievements, I think it kind of started when you climbed Shivling. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yes, it is. Shivling. Yeah, yeah. Shivas Mountain, yeah. In northern India, near the source of the Ganges. Mm-hmm. I guess so. I'd been climbing for quite a while already. My first expedition was in 1979 to Canada, to the Logan Mountains. Nice. And I'd never been in a plane before, so it was a great adventure. I was still at university at the time. And I'd been climbing in France and other places in Europe, but really how my outdoors life started was underground. I discovered caving when I was at high school and I absolutely loved it. I spent all my spare time, Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays, caving all over Belgium and all over Europe as well after a while.
Can I just stop you for a second? I guess people should also know, you're probably picking up the fact that there's a bit of an accent there. So when we're talking about your childhood and your schooling, we're talking about you growing up in Belgium?
We are, yes. Yep. French is my first language.
So you just mentioned as well Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays. Is that a different sort of schooling system you had going on there?
Well, I'm not sure what schooling is these days, but when I was at school, Wednesday afternoons, Saturdays and Sundays were free. So right. That's okay. When I went caving. Yeah, uh-huh. Anytime uh-huh. that I wasn't at school, I was caving, basically.
And there were caves nearby your home?
There were, close enough anyway. If I couldn't find anyone who had a car to go, I'd hop on my bike and ride. The closest one, I guess, that I did on my own was about 15 kilometers away, mm-hmm, up and down, mm-hmm, little valleys and little hills in Belgium. Mm-hmm. I was just totally obsessed, so anytime I could get there, I would find a way to get there, wherever there might be.
I'm wondering why you were obsessed with caving. I did caving as a teenager, okay, as well, and I absolutely loved it. But for a lot of people, they're kind of like, that's absolutely not anything they'd ever want to do. What was the draw for you?
Funnily enough, it was the space. Because in Belgium, everything is small and crowded. Even, you know, you can go for walks in the woods, you can lose yourself on the river or whatever, but there are factories everywhere, there are houses everywhere, there is culture everywhere, of course, lots of old buildings. But then, you know, if you discover caving like I did at high school, you get that window of darkness which opens onto another world. And once you're in the darkness, I mean, you've only got your little light that gives you a little bit of space. But then there's the dark around, and that dark becomes space. And it could be narrow, but you don't know because it's dark. You don't see anything.
And it's a darkness like you don't get anywhere else, isn't it? It's just complete black. You can't see your hand in front of your face.
Exactly, yeah. And it felt so comfortable. It really felt like I was at one with everything around me.
Would you go caving on your own?
I did go caving on my own, but the most fun, I think, was with other people, boys. Let's not forget, okay, I was 15, 16 at the time, and I was the only girl.
I was 15 once too.
No, I was a tomboy, you know, from way back. And I just loved being out there and pushing myself and having adventures. You know, I'm someone who grew up, my first book was a Tintin comic. Do you know Tintin?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and my mum would just put a book in a comic in my hands while she was doing the housework, and I would just sit there and lose myself in Tintin's adventures. And, of course, there were mountains and temples and treasures and jungles and all sorts of things. So when I finally got the opportunity to do something like Tintin, I just jumped in.
Oh, I love it. That's a wonderful. I've never heard an adventure tell me that they were inspired by Tintin before. That's wonderful.
There you go.
There you go. That's a first. So caving then led to what happened next for you?
Well, I met people, of course. That's what happens when you get out of your comfort zone and you just push yourself and you discover. Your horizon broadens. That's probably the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. And within that horizon, there are other people. And learning is really big for me. To me, as long as I'm learning, I'm alive. If I'm not learning anymore, what the hell am I doing on this planet? So the people I was meeting were teaching me whatever they knew. Caving, but also some of those cavers were into rock climbing, and that's how I finally poked my nose out of the hole and looked up, and whoa, there was a cliff there. And there are lots of limestone cliffs in Belgium along rivers. That's how I got into rock climbing.
Okay. And so I know that when you came to Australia and were rock climbing as well, how did you end up coming to Australia?
Oh, it happened in a funny way. At the end of the 1970s, everybody I knew who was a rock climber in Belgium had been climbing mountains overseas. And I thought, oh, that sounds really exciting, you know, even higher. And everybody at that time was going to Africa because it's closer to Europe than anywhere else. And their goal was usually Kenya. Mount Kenya was a favorite at the time, or Ruwenzori. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go and climb Mount Kenya. I was at university by that stage, doing my first year at uni, I think. And
what were you studying, just as a matter of interest?
I was studying archaeology, history of art, and musicology.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, another inspiration. Guess who? Indiana Jones.
I love it.
I do not have the hat. All the whip.
But you've got I was going to say all the whip.
I did try, but no, that wasn't for me.
But definitely the adventures, definitely the adventures.
Indeed, indeed, yes. So there I was at university doing archaeology. Prehistory was my favourite. Caves, fancy that. I wanted to find out how much a ticket to go to Africa was. And I had a friend, Marcel, who had a travel agency nearby. So I went and saw her and I said, all right, tell me, Marcel, how much is a ticket to Kenya? And she started looking at prices on her desk because there were no computers in those days. Yeah. And she told me, huh, that's interesting. The price of a ticket to Kenya is actually the same as the price of a ticket to Australia.
Wow,
and
that's so
that
much
was it.
Away.
You know, I just said, oh, forget about Kenya. That is so 1979. I'm going to Australia. So I did. I rounded up three friends and we hired a camper van and we did a tour around the eastern side of Australia and ended up at Mount Rapalies, of all places, because we were into rock climbing, and I'd written letters to a few different people who had climbing magazines in Australia at the time and didn't have much information, but everybody seemed to be thinking that the Rapalies was the place to go if you wanted to go rock climbing. So we ended up at Rapalies.
For people who don't know, who are listening, that's in Victoria. Just filling people in, yeah.
Yes, it's in my backyard. And has been since then. Yes, fell in love with the Rapalies. I met a lovely man at the time called Roddy McKenzie, and we ended up going out. Then through him I met John Muir, who became my husband, and that's how I ended up moving to Australia.
Mm-hmm. So I heard that when John became your husband, you were given a tent as a present, and you lived in a tent for the first 12 months of your marriage. Is that right?
Yeah, that was always a bit of a joke. Like, his parents bought us our first home.
Very generous of them.
Oh, I know. Forever grateful. Yeah, indeed. And that was a family tent, which we pitched at Mount Arapiles.
Well, and look, great in the summer, although hot, and then cold in the winter, I would think.
I come from Belgium, darling.
Yeah, true. As I said it, I thought, oh, no, perhaps not. it's all relevant.
It is. And in fact, as I speak to you, I'm sitting in my tent in my garden because I've got something about tents. I love camping. I think I've spent about 9 years of my life in a tent. And I cannot imagine having a house without having a tent to go to.
So you have a tent permanently set up in your backyard?
I do, yeah.
Ah.
Winter.
And what do you do in that tent?
I sleep. I write, I read, I look out of the window at the birds outside.
So that year in a tent, you were climbing every day, I imagine.
We were when we were at Rapalies. Now, there were other things that happened during our life based at Rapalies, and that was grape picking, because in those days that was how climbers made money to go climbing overseas. And once there was enough money to go to buy a ticket and go climbing in the Himalaya, we'd go climbing. India was a favourite at the time.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
If I skip now to heading off to Shivling and climbing that as your first probably big mountain, is that true and correct to say?
I guess so, yes. Yeah. It was a new route, so that was pretty special.
Uh-huh. And you were the first Australian woman to do that, is that right?
We were the first people anywhere climb that new route, the Southwest Ridge, on Shivling's west summit. Yeah, and that summit had only been climbed once.
So what was the draw for you for that particular mountain? Because, you know, as you know, there are many. Was it the draw of a new route? No one had ever done it before? Or,
you know what happens with mountains, for me anyway, I fall in love with a mountain. So that was part of it. It was a communal falling in love, I guess, because John was into it, and there were other people who came with us one first time, Ed Neve and Terry Tremble. Then we didn't get anywhere that year, and we went back the next year with Graham Hill, who ended up becoming my brother-in-law, actually. And that mountain is just so beautiful. Plus, it's very special. It's a spiritual space. There are lots of holy men living on a meadow just at the foot of the mountain. There is the source of the Ganges nearby, so there's all that mystique and that peak, which is just stunning. It's so beautiful. It kind of, you know, it's a big, I don't know how to describe it, but it just jumps into the sky almost. And that new route was the perfect line. It was so beautiful. It was very hard too, and we climbed it in yo-yo style, which meant that we would climb up to a certain point. There were 3 of us, as I said, Graham Hill, John Muir and myself, carry all our stuff there, then hop again, climb up to another place, another camp, move all our stuff there, and then do it again. It was very, very special. And it was very scary too, because it's very steep.
Mm. And had you, in terms of sort of the training for it, had you climbed peaks like that before?
Before Shivling? Oh, golly gosh. I'd climbed mountains in Europe. So, I'd done steep climbs before, but a new route, no, that was the first time, a new route, yep.
That would be incredibly thrilling, I would imagine, but also a great sense of, was it trepidation or fear, or how, what was the overwhelming feeling for you as you were sort of climbing? Excitement or a mix of everything?
If I've got to be honest about it, it was a very strange time because John and I were in the process of splitting up at the time. So it was a very emotional climb. And our liaison officer had actually died on the normal route that we were climbing as a warm-up for the new route. Totally unrelated to us. It was shocking. It was very sad that it happened. And we decided to keep going and go ahead with the new route. But all that meant, it was, gosh, it was a soap opera, basically. And we did get to the summit. And I remember Graham climbing that last very steep spire. And he gets to the top and he's just hardly any space there. And he goes around and he goes, where to now? And that was exactly my feeling at the time. You know, where to now? Where's life going to take me now?
I think for obviously the majority of the population who've never done anything like that, it's kind of hard to imagine what it must feel like when you get to the top of a mountain and have that sense of, I think it might be like, I can do anything now. I can, you know, anything I set my mind to. Is that how you felt?
Not that time, but, you know, I've never felt that on top of any mountain, quite frankly. Yeah. No, that's what you think once you're down the mountain.
Yeah, right.
Because it's all very well to get to the summit of a mountain, but there's also the small matter of coming down in one piece.
And I've heard a lot of climbers, high altitude climbers, say that's actually the more dangerous period of time as well, the coming down. Is that?
Absolutely right. You've lost your focus. You're not trying to reach a summit anymore.
Mm.
And you have to keep that focus going all the way down, step after step after step. Because if you make one mistake, it's not, oh, I'm going to hurt myself. It's, oh, I'm going to die.
I think it's one of those things that most people kind of can't fathom, really.
It's total focus. It's totally being in the here and now, which to me has always been the challenge in life. To be here and now, because that's all there is, and it's so hard to achieve in what I call real life.
I think you're absolutely right, isn't it? And there are activities that people do in real life. For instance, say gardening, you know, and you're fully present in that moment, and you know, which is why it's, I guess, a gift for people. But yes, I can't. I think people climbing a mountain is a whole other level of in the now.
It is, yes. And, yeah, I'm still working on doing that here and now.
So what we might do is move on to, so you've done that. I hate that term, bagged that peak, because I feel like it really doesn't sum up what you've done. But you've achieved that goal. And then what happens for you from then on? What are your next plans, your next thoughts about where you want to go, what you want to achieve?
Okay, so we're getting towards 1988 now. And, oh, I went to the Karakoram in 87 to climb in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. The aim of the exercise was to climb Kashubrim 2. And it was a very bad season. Lots of people died. The expedition fell into bits. Most people left and I ended up staying on with Jeff Little and Lydia Brady. We joined a Basque expedition and we were there to climb Hidden Peak, but that didn't happen because of avalanches and people dying, as I was mentioning. Then we stayed on and got onto Kashubrim 2 illegally. Very naughty.
Rule breaker.
But I didn't get to the summit. I have problems with my sight. I'm short-sighted, and I was wearing contact lenses, and I lost one of them. And I decided it was wiser to come down rather than keep going and risk tripping over. But they went on to the summit, so climbed it and came back down. Mm-hmm. And so that was 87, and of course I learned a lot on that trip about, you know, what I could and could not do, and by then, John and I had gone our separate ways, and in 88 he was invited to go and be a member of the Australian Bicentennial Everest Expedition. And I was not.
How did I that would have, I feel like that would have riled me.
Oh, it did. It did rile me big time.
Putting it mildly.
Mildly. Yeah. So what did I do? I remembered someone that we'd met in 1984 when John was climbing the West Ridge of Everest with Peter Hillary and a few other climbers. That guy was called Bill Bass, and he was an American millionaire who had climbed the highest peak on each continent. And I thought, I like traveling. I like climbing mountains. And I need a long-term goal. So why not that? And I lost myself into climbing the highest peak on each continent. That's how it started. It was a bit of a sore there. And also the fact that I was always really good at starting things and not finishing them. And I was really a dare to myself. Don't stop until you climb those seven summits.
And I think from some reading I've done that you had hoped that you would do that quite quickly. Is that right?
Yes, I was hoping to, you know, find sponsorship. Well, I was working for the ones that were affordable. I just got jobs, you know, whatever was going really, and saved money and went and climbed. But when it came to the expensive ones, Vincent in Antarctica and Everest in Asia, I had to find sponsorship.
And was that hard to find sponsorship?
It certainly wasn't easy. It's a full-time job looking for sponsors. It's And what happened was that it wasn't my story anymore. It became more than a one-person story. Of course, John was always there to support me morally and however we could. But to find money, I need people weighing the game, and people like Ann Tindall, who was a video producer in Melbourne, Ian Darling, who's a dear friend in Sydney, and they helped me find money to go to climb Everest and Vincent. And it was just so special to be able to feel that I was inspiring them, and at the same time to be inspired by what they were doing and the fact that they believed in me. That was the biggest surprise to me. It was like, wow, these people are actually giving me their time and they believe in me. Wow.
Did that help? Yeah, I feel like it's always amazing when anyone believes in me. So so I can totally appreciate that sense. Well, Vincent and Everest, the last two that you needed to summit. Yeah. And so I know that with the Antarctic trip, you started your own guiding company to help fund that.
That's right, yes.
I thought that was a genius move.
When there's a will, there is a way.
That's right.
And I was very determined. Yes. So, yeah, guided on Aconcagua for quite a while. And Vincent, I got a client to go to Vincent, so that was great. And I managed to get sponsorship to plug the hole, because one client was definitely not enough to pay for the two of us to get to Mount Vincent. And he didn't get to the summit, John from Melbourne, but I did. It was terrible weather, really, really bad.
The winds, yes.
We ended up spending 10 days in our little tent waiting for the wind to abate. And let me tell you, that wasn't fun.
Because the waiting.
Not just the waiting. It was raining inside the tent because it was snowing outside. And, of course, I was cooking inside the tent, feeding us. And so it was rain for 10 days plus. I don't know, but the smell in the tent after 10 days of sharing a tiny mountain tent with a man.
I was interesting. Well, imagine. Well, maybe I can't imagine, actually.
You don't want to.
I don't want to imagine. That's exactly right. Oh, dear me. That's it for part one of our conversation with Brigitte Muir. Don't forget to join us for part two. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic.
And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening, and hear you next time.